Sukadeva Goswami continued, the son of Rohita was Harita. So Rohita's father was? He was the son of Harishchandra. So his father was Harishchandra. And Harita's son was Champa, who constructed the town of Champapuri. Raise your hand if you've been to Champapuri. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of Champapuri. Yes. The son of Champa was Sudev, and his son was Vijay. The son of Vijay was Baruka. Baruka's son was Vrika, and Vrika's son was Bahuka. So this is quite a few generations. The enemies of King Bahuka took away all his possessions, and therefore the king entered the order of Vanaprastha and went to the forest with his wife. So this is a tendency that the people of olden days had. We struggle in our life to accumulate something in somewhat a materialistic way, because that is the nature of youth, to want to accumulate, to gain one's position in life. And then something may occur and one loses everything that one had attempted, the empire that one had attempted to build. And this is because there is a superimposition of oneself on one's possessions and one's successes. So there's a feeling when one loses everything that one is losing oneself, that one has no reason to exist, to be alive anymore. And practically speaking, one feels, I might as well die. This is a tendency in the materialistic way of thinking. So a pious person, when one loses everything in that way, what will he do? He will turn to the Supreme Lord. Artha gigyasa artha ti gyani cha bharatasava. Because he's already died in consciousness. This is what happens when one loses one's possessions or what one's attempted to achieve in one's life. One feels like one has died himself. And what next? Where do we look? So this, as Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj had spoken of near the end of his life, he spoke of dying before dying, and this is what it means: to give up willingly that which is going to be taken from one anyway, and using the opportunity to take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because ultimately we don't possess anything in this world. It is not possible for the soul to possess anything. There is a feeling, a sense of this is mine. Again, it's because of the superimposition of the self on something. If someone's shoes get stolen, superficially, I'll say, oh, too bad, Prabhu, or someone's computer or camera or motorcycle or whatever, or money, oh, too bad. But there's no real feeling of pain there. But because I haven't superimposed my feeling of me, of mine, that feeling of self upon these objects, because it's someone else's, that someone else has superimposed that feeling on those objects. Of course, if it's my friend who has lost something, then I'm superimposing that minus on him. And because he's superimposed it on his possession, I might feel something. Or my country, or my community. So all this false, illusory sense of minus, superimposed on things that actually have nothing to do with us. My shoes are stolen,
I'm angry. Someone else's shoes have stolen. Who cares? This is reality. Who cares? But everything that we identify with that isn't actually us isn't ours in this world. And we're going to have to give that up. So a pious person, when he loses something in this world that pushes him, that feeling of loss of self is what the Buddhists call a little death. The big death, the major death, is when we lose the body. That we've superimposed that sense of mine, of me, upon something, the body, and therefore it is mine. I lose that, that's the big death. So in preparation for the big death, we have to face all the little deaths in the same way that we should face the big death, the real death of the body, which doesn't at all touch the eternal soul. And that way is Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. Let me take shelter of you. What shelter do I have in this world? See how powerful the illusory energy is. It has made me think something that is not me and cannot be mine. It has made me to think that indeed it is me and it is mine, and therefore I experience pain because of the superimposition of identity on something that has nothing to do with me. So this is the practice of life, going through life, taking shelter of Krishna in all times. So Bahuka died when he was old. So he entered the order of Vanaprastha, went to the forest with his wife, and he died when he was old. And one of his wives wanted to die with him, following the sati rite. The sati rite is something that's impossible, practically speaking, to understand nowadays. Sati means chaste. So for a chaste wife in bygone ages, the pain of being separated from our husband, the full identification, the superimposition of the self upon her husband, this is my husband, my protector, my pati, was so great, the pain was so great, it would burn her heart so much that it was intolerable, and she preferred to the lesser pain of the funeral pyre along with her husband. It was a natural thing of bygone ages. It's completely unnatural in this age. So Urva Muni, knowing that she was pregnant, the co-wives of the wife of Bahuka conspired to give her poison with her food. So forbade her to die because she was with child. But the poison did not act. Instead, the son was born along with the poison. Therefore, he became famous as Saghara, one who was born with poison, Saghara. Saghara later became the emperor. The place known as Ganga Sagara was excavated by his sons. Has anyone been to Ganga Sagara? Yes. This is Kapila Muni's ashram, huh? Not that Ganga Sagara. This one you're talking about in Sridhar Mayapur. Yeah. I think it's near Calcutta, this one. Huh? Yes, it's the Kapila Muni's ashram is there. It's the place of Kapila Muni. And now we hear something about that. Because we hear that, and this is where Rahugana Maharaj was going when he met Jad Bharat. He was going to learn Sankhya. He was going to visit Kapila Ashram there at the Ganga Sagara. So Sagara Maharaj, so this is where Kapila Muni went when he left his mother Devahuti. What canto? Third canto. So Sagara Maharaj, following the order of his spiritual master, Ova, well, that was the spiritual master of his father as well, did not kill the uncivilized men
like the Talanjangas, the Yavanas, Shakas, Haihais, and Barbaras. I guess the word barbarian comes from that word. Huh? It links it. Instead, some of them he made dress awkwardly. Some of them he shaved clean. So these were the Vedic, the Vanashrama system applied to the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Sudras. So there were those who were not following the Vanashrama system. So they were designated clearly as being outside of the system. So some he shaved clean but allowed to wear mustaches. Some of them he left wearing loose hair. Some he half-shaved. Some he left without underwear and some without external garments. Thus these different clans were made to dress differently, but King Sagara did not kill them. This is probably explained somewhere else in a little more detail what happened. Following the instructions of the great sage Orva, Sagara Maharaj performed Aswamedha sacrifices and thus satisfied the Supreme Lord, who is the Supreme Controller, the Supersoul of all learned scholars and the knower of all Vedic knowledge, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So these are all the words that are used in the verse. Harim Atmanam Ishwaram, like this. So he is the Supreme Lord. But Indra, the king of heaven, stole the horse meant to be offered at the sacrifice.
Was it before the tomb?
Not in the Bhagavatam, clearly. Many cantos later. But you can look at the genealogical table at the end and see if you can make some parallels. Prithviraj was in which dynasty? Same as Dhruva Maharaj, so that's Swayambhuva Manu. So much earlier. This is much later Manu. King Sagara had two wives, Sumati and Keshini. The sons of Sumati, who were very proud of their prowess and influence, following the order of their father, searched for the lost horse. While doing so, they dug into the earth very extensively. Thereafter, in the northeastern direction, they saw the horse near the ashram of Kapila Muni. "Here is the man who has stolen the horse," they said. "He is staying there with closed eyes. Certainly, he is very sinful. Kill him. Kill him." So Sukadeva has already described these sons as very proud. Proud of what? Their prowess and their influence. So everyone is longing for strength and abilities and to be able to influence others. And every positive thing in this world will have a negative attached to it. We want to be intelligent. We want to be beautiful. We want to be wealthy. As if those things will purely satisfy us, will satisfy us. But along with those things comes negative things, such as
pride
is the specific one here. But also, what other negative thing comes along? What? Yes. What way? What were you thinking of?
Is that with the appearances?
Yes.
With the attachment to wealth comes.
So it's a long chain. In a chain, suffering ultimately will result.
Yes.
But what are the intermediary things that happen? You have to defend it because, which is the one I'm looking at. Yes. And anything that gives you pleasure. But why do you have to defend it? Because they're envious of you. And that's one of the first things that happens. As soon as you gain something, you're more intelligent than other people. You start thinking I'm more intelligent than people. And people immediately notice that. Oh, this person is so proud. Who does he think he is? We'll fix him. We'll give him the treatment. And they become envious. Especially in university departments. You'd think that the very, very brahminical there. but I've heard this from quite a few university professors. They're infamous for the kind of politics that goes on there, and the jockeying for the position of chairman. And someone becomes chairman, and it's like the politics. Yeah, and someone steals his horse or something like that. This is the material world. Because everyone here is essentially envious. Why? If we're envious of some person who's more beautiful than us, just imagine how envious we are of Krishna, who possesses all beauty. If we're envious of someone who has more wealth than us, just imagine how envious we are of Krishna, who possesses all wealth. So it is everything in this world is mixed. The results are mixed. If you're poor, terrible. But no one's envious of you. People will help you. Everything has its... Every negative will have its positive side. Every positive will have its negative side. So pride is one of the first things that happens to a human being when he obtains some opulence by Krishna's grace, by his good fortune, by his karma. So these gentlemen were proud. He's staying there with closed eyes. Certainly he is very sinful. Kill him, kill him. Shouting like this, the sons of Sagara, 60,000 altogether, raised their weapons. When they approached the sage opened his eyes. By the influence of Indra, the king of heaven, the sons of Sagara had lost their intelligence and disrespected a great personality. Consequently, fire emanated from their own bodies, and they were immediately burned to ashes. So the fire didn't actually emanate from Kapila Muni's eyes, but it emanated from their own bodies. Prabhupada's short purport here. I will read 12 first and then read the purport. It is sometimes argued that the sons of King Sagara were burnt to ashes by the fire emanating from the eyes of Kapila Muni, in other words, his anger. This statement, however, is not approved by great learned persons. For Kapila Muni's body is completely in the mode of goodness and therefore cannot manifest the mode of ignorance in the form of anger, just as the pure sky cannot be polluted by the dust of the earth. What does that mean? That example is given quite often. Just as the sky cannot be polluted by the dust of the earth. What does that mean? Because we see, and especially if you've been here in the summer, there are these dust storms that turn the whole sky reddish almost. So what does that mean, that the sky cannot be polluted?
The air may be polluted, but the space itself is not really affected by whatever
is. Is that what is meant? Is it differentiating between the sky and the ether and akash and vayu or something? I don't think so. No, I think, and I'd have to say I think here, unless we can see the Sanskrit words here. How I understood it, in a simple way, is an example that we give quite often, that the dust never actually mixes with the air. It never mixes with the air. There's the dust, there's the air, and they appear to be together, just like the water. If you take mud and put it in water, it is not that the water is polluted by the mud, because if you just leave it for some time, the mud will settle right out of the water. There is no actual combining or pollution of the water. So I think it's that simple point there. So there is a separation between the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Lord Kapila Muni, and the modes of nature, such as ignorance. They can never pollute his consciousness. They can never enter into his consciousness. It is not possible. So here's Prabhupada's purport to 11. The material body is a combination of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. There is already fire within the body. And our practical experience is that the heat of this fire sometimes increases and sometimes decreases. The fire within the bodies of the sons of Sagara Maharaj became so much hotter that all of them burnt to ashes. The fire increased heat was due to their misbehavior towards the Great Personality. Such misbehavior is called Mahad Vyaktikrama, an overstepping of proper behavior towards the Mahat, or the great souls. They were killed by the fire of their own bodies because of insulting a great personality. Kapila Muni enunciated in this world the Sankhya philosophy, which is a strong boat, it is text 13, with which to cross over the ocean of nescience. Indeed, a person eager to cross the ocean of the material world may take shelter of this philosophy. And such a greatly learned person, situated on the elevated platform of transcendence, how can there be any distinction between enemy and friend? Because that is the enemies and friendness that attack our mind, this mentality, it's been rejected by Prahlad Maharaj in Canto 7 in speaking with Sandanamarka in his prayers. Because this is just the mind, the material mind working, it's accepting and it's rejecting this and that. Purport. One who is promoted to the transcendental position, Brahma Bhuta, is always jubilant, prasanatma. He is unaffected by the false distinctions between good and bad in the material world. Therefore, such an exalted person, because that's what we're saying, we think to gain opulence is good, and we think to be poor is bad. But to gain opulence is good, but it also has something bad attached to it. People become envious of you, one tends to become proud, especially with wealth. The Bhagavatam actually explains this, that nothing makes one prouder than possessing wealth. So, an exalted person above, one who is exalted means above, one who is above the modes of material nature, he does not distinguish between friend and enemy. Because he's on the absolute platform, free from material contamination, he is called Paratma Bhuta or Brahma Bhuta. Kapila Muni, therefore, was not at all angry at the sons of Sagara Maharaj. Rather, they were burnt to ashes by the heat of their own bodies. 15:16. Formerly, in his previous birth, Asamanjasa had been a great mystic yogi, but by bad association, he had fallen from his exalted position. Now in this life, he was born in a royal family and was a Jati Smara, that is, he had the special advantage of being able to remember his past birth. Nonetheless, he wanted to display himself as a miscreant. So who is Asamanjasa? Oh, we forgot, we skipped the verse. Okay, 14. Among the sons of Sagara Maharaj was one named Asamanjasa, who was born from the king's second wife, Kesini. So he wasn't there with them, his other sons who became burnt to ashes. The son of Asamanjasa was known as Amsuman, and he was always engaged in working for the good of Sagara Maharaj, his grandfather. Formerly, in his previous birth, so there are three generations there. There's Sagara Maharaj, Asamanjasa, and Amsuman. So Asamanjasa had been a great mystic yogi, but by bad association, he had fallen from his exalted position. Now in this life, he was born in a royal family, Suchiman Shimatande Gehe Yoga Brashta Vajayate, and was a Jati Smara, that is, he had the special advantage of being able to remember his past birth. Nonetheless, he wanted to display himself as a miscreant, and therefore he would do things that were abominable in the eyes of the public and unfavorable to his relatives. Like whom? Like Jalbar. He would disturb the boys sporting in the river Sarayu. So this is all the dynasties that were the kings of Ayodhya. By throwing them into the depths of the water. Because Asamanjasa engaged in such abominable activities, his father gave up affection for him. So if your father gives up affection for you, is that good or bad? It's bad. It depends on the father and it depends on the son. And it depends on whether you can remember your previous birth or not. And it depends whether you want him to give up affection for you. But generally that's bad, but there's a blessing attached to it. It's because one is free then. Is it good to be free? Well, it depends what is one going to do with one's freedom, whether it's good to be free. Because when we're free, we can get ourselves into a lot more trouble than when we're obliged to so many other people. But if one is spiritually exalted and won't fall into the traps of the modes of material nature, then one like Asamanjasam, wishing to be free from family affection, just see the mentality here. Why didn't he just leave? Why did he act in this way? Because he wanted his father to reject him so that he could be free and take up his spiritual life. But why didn't he just leave then? Yes, it could be that. Things like that, yes. And my father will be so pained. So he consciously, or he'll follow me or something, if we take it that side. But clearly, by doing it in this way, he was really free, because the father actually had given up the ropes of his affection for him, that attachment, and had him exile, go out of this city. You're cruel. Who else did this? What other king lost his affection? He reacted differently. Maharaj Anga, yes. Yes? Yes, yes. But specifically, in the Kshatriya royal dynasty, that Anga Maharaj, instead of him exiling Vena, he exiled himself. Because this was his attachment was strong. The attachment for the father for the son is deeper, stronger than the attachment of the son for the father, even. So he said, Anga Maharaj said, this is actually a blessing. Otherwise I'd be so attached. It's better to have a bad son than a good son, he said. So after he exiled him, then Asamanjasa exhibited his mystic power by reviving the boys. So he threw them into the deep water and they had died, and showing them to the king and their parents. But the exile had been spoken. After this, Asamanjasa left Ayodhya. Prabhupada's short purport. Asamanjasa was Jati Smaran, Smara. Because of his mystic power, he did not forget his previous consciousness. Thus, he could give life to the dead. By exhibiting wonderful activities in relation to the dead children, he certainly attracted the attention of the king and the people in general. Then he left that place immediately. O King Pariksit, when all the inhabitants of Ayodhya saw that their boys had come back to life, they were astounded. And King Sagara greatly lamented the absence of his son. Thereafter, Amsuman, the grandson of Maharaj Sagara, was ordered by the king to search for the horse. He had sent out 60,000 sons, and they did not return. And then he sent out his grandson, because his son, Asumandasa, he left, so he didn't have anyone to send. So the grandson was ordered to search for the horse. Following the same path traversed by his uncles, Amsuman gradually reached the stack of ashes and found the horse nearby. Now, will he fall into the same trap as his uncles and try to kill Kapila Muni? No. The great Amsuman saw the sage named Kapila, the saint who is an incarnation of Vishnu, sitting there by the horse. Amsuman offered him respectful obeisances, folded his hands, and offered him prayers with great attention. So we can see what happened with the uncles. And Because they just assumed there was the sage sitting there with closed eyes, and there was the horse near him, post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means the cause, there's a cause there, and therefore it has made the effect. There's a direct connection between something we're assuming is the cause and the effect. But there was no direct connection between Kapila Muni and the horse. So how simpler, how we do that also, in case we haven't noticed, all the time. And then I see this, that you get angry at someone or something, and then you find that it really didn't have anything to do with them at all, and then you have to suffer the embarrassment of having to confront your own consciousness, but at least no one else knows because you kept it inside like that. But to take this tack, just if they would have, 60,000 of them would have offered their obeisances, they would have ended up with the horse, and they would have ended up having respected a great sage, but this pastime wouldn't have taken place. So therefore we can understand the hand of the Lord is in there, and Indra's hand was already mentioned. So he folded his hands and offered him prayers with great attention. So there are six verses here of prayers. Now, as I've been mentioning throughout this ninth canto especially, we should look at everything that's said in relationship to what's going to happen in the next canto, which is the introduction of the Supreme Personality of Godhood. Or rather, he'll be introduced at the end of this canto, in the ninth canto, the birth of Krishna. Or not the birth, but the speaking about him. But here, since this is the ninth canto, let us see what this has in relationship to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God, and how this prepares our consciousness for him. So Amsuman said to Kapila, "My Lord," so we've just heard that he was an incarnation of Vishnu, and Vishnu, of course, is Angsa, Krishna Stu Bhagavan. So it takes Angs, Kalapung Son, Krishna Stu Bhagavan. Amsuman said, "My Lord, even Lord Brahma is to this very day unable to understand your position." First point. Does that apply to Krishna? Even Lord Brahma, we will see in chapter 13 and 14, he is unable, this is the first words that he speaks in the first two verses of chapter 14 in canto 10. He says, "Others may say they know something about God, but I will never say that. There is so much a difference between the potency of your transcendental body and mine that I cannot even estimate the difference." Even Lord Brahma is to this day unable to understand your position, which is far beyond himself, either by meditation or by mental speculation. So what to speak of others like us, who have been created by Brahma in various forms as demigods, animals, human beings, birds and beasts, regardless of the body we happen to be dwelling within? No one can understand Krishna, in fact, because he is so far beyond us in potency, regardless of what type of body we have. We are completely in ignorance. We can't understand by the usual methods of using our intellectual capacities. And therefore, he asks a very intelligent question. Therefore, how can we know you, who are the transcendents? How then are you to be known? This is basically what Kunti Devi has asked in the first canto as well. Let's go through his prayers. There's six of them, and then we'll go back and read that purport of Prabhupada's. "My Lord," so the question is, he's asking, how can we know you, understand you, who are the transcendents? "My Lord, you are fully situated in everyone's heart." So he's beyond. So he's transcendental, beyond, but he's also immanent. He's also present everywhere. and he's present in everyone's heart. But we can't understand. You are fully situated in everyone's heart. Fully situated means with all your potency. But the living entities covered by the material body cannot see you, for they are influenced by the external energy conducted by the three modes of material nature. So what is causing our inability to understand Krishna, even though, because we can say, oh Lord, you are so far away, we cannot understand you. But he's not so far away. He is so far away, but he's also as close as our own heart. But still we can't understand him. That's like we may not understand what the island in the Pacific called Tonga is like. Because it, Tonga, do you know what Tonga is like? The island Tonga? I'm asking the wrong person, I'm sure. No, okay, I'm asking the right person. We don't know, it's so far away. You know what Zagreb is like? Yeah. Okay. Let's see. But Krishna is not only far away, but he's also close, so close, but still we can't understand him. So this is the question. How is he to be understood? And what is the thing that is causing us, causing our inability to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, although he's as close as our own heart? And it describes here in this prayer, it's the external energy, the three modes of material nature. Goodness, ignorance, and passion. Their intelligence being covered by sattvagun, rajagun, and tamagun, they can see only the actions and reactions of these three modes of material nature. We don't, when we open our eyes and look at the world, what we see is our own minds. We see through our minds, we don't see reality as it is. One person sees something wonderful, another person will see something detestable, and they'll be seeing seemingly the same object. We see through our minds, and our minds are different influences of the modes of material nature. Because of the actions and reactions of the modes of ignorance, whether the living entities are awake or sleeping, they can see only the workings of the material nature. They cannot see your lordship. So that's all one sees when one has material consciousness. People look for God and see him nowhere, people in general. And someone who is spiritually exalted looks for God and sees him everywhere. Oh my Lord, sages, so the point here, since the modes of material nature are inhibiting, stopping our ability to see the Lord, forcing us to see, covering our consciousness, forcing us to see only matter, then who therefore can see the Lord, one who is beyond the modes of material nature? So that's 23. O my Lord, sages freed from the influence of the three modes of material nature, sages such as the four Kumaras, Sanakan, Sanandan, and Sanata, are able to think of you, who are concentrated knowledge. But how can an ignorant person like me think of you? Oh, completely. So what's the answer to that? Huh? But if we perform devotional service influenced by the three modes of material nature, we actually won't see him. If we perform pure devotional service, anyabhidasita sanyam jnana kama anavrita, then, by Krishna's mercy, we can see him. O completely peaceful Lord. Now remember, so how is Krishna to be seen? This is what we're talking about. Amsuman is talking about. O completely peaceful Lord, Although material nature, fruit of activities, and their consequent material names and forms are your creation, you are unaffected by them. Therefore, your transcendental name is different from material names, and your form is different from material forms. So Krishna, and then it continues to make this point further, you assume a form resembling a material body just to give us instructions like those of the Bhagavad Gita. But actually, you are the Supreme Original Person. I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto you. So Krishna's form resembles the form of a human being. But the modes of material nature which affect the form of a human being have nothing to do with Krishna's transcendental form. And because we, our consciousness is covered and controlled by the three modes of material nature, when we look at Krishna's form, we look at him playing with the cowherd boys, we look at him crying, we look at him stealing, we look at him dancing with the gopis, we see matter because our mind is matter. And that will not allow us to see Krishna. But you are the Supreme Original Person. Although matter is created by you, your form is not material, it has nothing to do with matter. And therefore, his conclusion here is, Nama Mahe Tvam Purusham Puranam. I offer my humble obeisances unto you, the Supreme Person, the original, oldest Supreme Person. O my Lord. Now, moving on. There's till 26, two more verses. O my Lord, those whose hearts are bewildered by the influence of lust, greed, envy, and illusion are interested only in false hearth and home in this world created by your Maya. Attached to home, wife, and children, they wander in this material world perpetually. O Supersoul, so this is those who have the modes of material nature, consciousness, affected and infected by the modes of material nature, filled with the whips, or beaten by the whips caused by the three modes of material nature, lust, anger, greed, envy, illusion, etc. They're attached to the things of this world. But O Supersoul of all living entities, O Personality of Godhead, simply by seeing you, I have now been freed from all lusty desires, which are the root cause of insurmountable illusion and bondage in the material world. So this is quite interesting, because the question is raised, how can we see you? And the answer is, how can we understand you? And the answer is, by his example, is by seeing you, we can understand you. Well, how can you see him, though? But this is the process. But when the consciousness comes in touch with Krishna, then it is purified. And that is bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is not of this world. As we say, Golokeda Premadana Harinama. It comes from the spiritual world. It's an energy of the spiritual world. And when the conditioned soul, covered by the material energy, places himself, which are like clouds covering his actual consciousness, he places himself in the sun, continuously in the sun of the spiritual energy, then the consciousness becomes cleared, and then he can see things as they are. He can see Krishna as he is. So that's the process. So what is the process? To chant Krishna's names, to hear about Krishna. Bhavo sadasutam sotamanam brahmat. And it is not even a difficult process in the sense of, you think of, romantically we might think, oh, I'd like to practice yoga, but it's so difficult. You have to perform asanas for so many years and then live such an austere life outside of the cities in some lonely holy place, or and be completely renounced jnana yoga and bhakti, and the senses cannot be engaged at all. Very difficult. The mind, we saw with Sobari Muni, he was practicing mystic yoga. It was so powerful, and he so powerful that he could transform. Transform his body into a young man's body, and he became attractive to the daughters of Mahata, Mandata. But still, by looking at the fish, his mind became captivated, because that's the weakness of all these type of yogas. When we're pulling back from the material world, we can't pull back from ourself, our mind. We take it with us. So therefore, the process of bhakti yoga is quite different from that. It's without identifying oneself as the body, it is to Rishikesha, sarva upadi vinyamuktam tatparadvena niyamalam. To think of oneself, to understand oneself as a soul, as eternal, as Krishna's servant. And in that mood, with detachment, with neutrality, not overly detached or overly attached, then Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Serve the master of the senses with our senses, with whatever we have, whatever we're given, whatever position we're in, thinking that it is Krishna's. I'm Krishna's, everything is, let me use everything in Krishna's service with a great desire to please him, but with no passion and no ignorance and really no goodness, although goodness is the jumping off point for this. So very interesting. By seeing you, because the question here again is that the interesting point, how can we understand you due to our modes of material nature? And then he says, by seeing you, the insurmountable illusion and bondage, I've been freed from it all. So quite wonderful. So this is Krishna consciousness, to be engaged continuously, 24 hours a day, as Prabhupada would say, and chanting and hearing, serving in one way or another, but the center is Krishna, and the consciousness is focused on pleasing Krishna. So, very soon, as far as the Bhagavatam is concerned, very soon we're going to see Krishna. Very soon we will see Krishna. And if we keep our mind on Krishna, and we see Krishna through our ears, yad yad diyatad urugaiva vibhavayanti tam tam praniyeshe saranugraha, by his mercy he will situate himself in our hearts by the process of hearing. So let's go back and read those purports, and then we'll finish the chapter 27 to 30. Go back to the purports in his prayers. The first one talked about how can we know you who are the transcendentist? How can matter contact spirit? And what was the conclusion again? The sages who had, what stops us? The modes of material nature. The sages can do it. This is the same thing Kunti Devi said. Yata paramahansanam yoginam amalapmanam. Huh? He said, by seeing Krishna. In other words, placing ourselves in purely in contact with Krishna. And there we follow the process of doing that. All science, icha dvesha. So here's Prabhupada's purport to 21. Icha dvesha samutena dvanva mohena bharata sava bhutani sammoham sage anti parantapa. All seeing of Bharata, Arjuna, O conqueror of the foe, all living entities, so we see who's the foe here, are born into delusion, overcome by the dualities of desire and hate, ichcha and dvesha, aversion and attraction. All living beings in the material world are influenced by the three modes of material nature. Even Lord Brahma is in the mode of goodness. Similarly, the demigods are generally in the mode of passion. And living entities lower than the demigods, such as human beings and animals, are in the mode of ignorance or in mixed goodness, passion, and ignorance. So many different mixtures there. Therefore, Amsuman wanted to explain that because his uncles, who had been burnt to ashes, were under the modes of material nature, they could not understand Lord Kapiladev. Because you are beyond even the direct and indirect intelligence of Lord Brahma. So they're innocent. They could not understand. How could they understand who you were? He prayed, unless we are enlightened by your lordship, it will not be possible for us to understand you. Atapite devapadam bhujadvaya prasadaleshan guttevihi janati tattvam bhagavan mahim no nachanyeko apicharam vachinvan. My lord, if one is favored by even a slight trace of the mercy of your lotus feet, so here's the conclusion. Really, is how can he be seen and known? Really, by his mercy. And how does one come in contact with the processes of devotional service? By his mercy. And who carries his mercy? It's the devotees. If one is favored by even a slight trace of your mercy, of the mercy of your lotus feet, he can understand the greatness of your personality. But those who speculate to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead are unable to know you, even though they continue to study the Vedas for many years. The Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, can be understood by one who is favored by the Lord. The Lord cannot be understood by others. So that is the meditation of a devotee, is how to please Krishna. That's all. And then if he wants, he can bestow his mercy and let me see him. Okay. Text 22. We only see the workings of the modes of material nature. Here's Prabhupada's purport. We don't see Krishna even though he's in the heart. Unless one is situated in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, one is unable to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord is situated in everyone's heart. However, because the conditioned souls are influenced by material nature, they can only see the actions and reactions of material nature, but not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Mudoyam nabijananti lokomam ajam avyayam. One therefore must purify himself internally and externally. Apavitra pavitro va savavastum gato piva yachmaret pundarikaksham sabhayam abhyantara suci. So what's the process of purifying oneself? To keep ourselves externally clean, we should bathe 3 times a day. And for internal cleanliness, we must cleanse the heart by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. The members of this yachmaret pundarikaksham, the remembrance of the lotus-eyed Lord, the members of the Krishna consciousness movement must always follow this principle. Yaya bhaya abhyantara suci. Then it will be, one day, it will be possible to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. 23. Because only one in the three modes of material nature can understand you. The word swabhava refers to one's own spiritual nature or original constitutional position. When situated in its original position, the living entity is unaffected by the modes of material nature. Sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. As soon as one is freed from the influence of the three modes of material nature, he is situated on the Brahman platform. Vivid examples of personalities thus situated are the four Kumaras and Narad. Such authorities can by nature, so soon as one is above the modes of nature, then it is possible for them to understand. The four Kumaras were above the modes of material nature, but they couldn't understand until they actually saw the Lord. Or actually, even before they saw the Lord, what happened? That was? That was? No, I'm sorry. They smelled the fragrance of the tulsi that was offered to the lotus feet of Krishna. The breeze. Did anyone read that part in the unveiling, his lotus feet book? No, not yet. Because there's some wonderful comments by that we included of Vishwanath Chakravarti, of Jiva Goswami from the Sandarbhas. And there on that, it describes their conversion experience. Quite wonderful. Such authorities by nature can understand the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but a conditioned soul not freed from the influence of material nature is unable to realize the Supreme. In Bhagavad Gita, therefore, Krishna advises Arjuna, Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nistrigunyo Bhavarjuna. One must rise above the influence of the three modes of material nature. One who stays within the influence of the three material modes is unable to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then text 24. Your form is not material, even though it resembles material forms. Srila Jamunacharya has recited this verse in his Stotra Ratna. Who is Jamunacharya? Baba? Yes. Bole. Of Namacharya? Of Namacharya. Natamun. Yes. He was the Acharya. So he was a king, and then he was rescued from being a king by seeing the beautiful form of Ranganath. Huh? We should go there, but not now. We almost went. We almost went. But instead we brought him here. So, Jamunacharya has recited this verse. Bhavantam evanucharan narantara prashantanehisha manura tantara kadahamait kantiki nityakan kinkara prahasar yishyami sanatal jivatam. By serving you constantly, one is freed from all material desires and is completely pacified. So what's the key word in there? The constantly sticks out, doesn't it? Because we serve him, perhaps not so constantly sometimes, and we serve our minds and our own desires, and that gets its way in there, and therefore we don't quite get free from material desires, what to speak of being completely pacified, because Krishna Bhaktin is kam atta eva shanta. When shall I engage as your permanent eternal servant and always feel joyful to have such a fitting master? Sanata. What does sanata mean? Huh? No, no, no. What is sanata? Huh? What does anatta mean? Anatta. It means an orphan. Yes. This is very difficult to be an orphan. So sanatta is the opposite of anatta. It means having a guardian, one to serve, one to take care of. Manoratena seto davato bahi. So the prayers of Jamunacharya are so nice. One who acts on the mental platform must descend to material activities. Material contamination, however, is completely absent from the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his pure devotee. Therefore, the Lord is addressed as completely peaceful, free from the disturbances of material existence. Yes? Completely peaceful and free from the disturbances of material existence. The Supreme Lord has no material name or form. Only the foolish think that the Lord's name and form are material. avajananti mamudha manusam tanamasrita. The identity of the Supreme Lord is that he is the original person. Nonetheless, those who have but a poor fund of knowledge think that the Lord is formless. The Lord is formless in the material sense, that he has no material form, but he has transcendental form, Satchit Ananda Vigraha. His form is full of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. So that's the end of the purports and to his prayers written by Srila Prabhupada. And now, completing the chapter. O King Prickett, when Amsuman had glorified the Lord in this way, pulling his mercy, depending on his mercy, and asking for it, and being fully sincere in doing so, the great sage Kapila, the powerful incarnation of Vishnu, being very merciful to him, explained to him the path of knowledge. The personality of God had said, "My dear Amsuman, here is the animal sought by your grandfather for sacrifice. Please take it. As for your forefathers who have been burnt to ashes, they can be delivered only by Ganges water and not by any other means." So where has that been related? Where has that been related? Yeah? So he brought down the Ganga. That was generations. It took generations to do this. Thereafter, Amsuman circumambulated Kapila Muni and offered him respectful obeisances, bowing his head. After fully satisfying him in this way, so he fully satisfied him. And in what way? He just basically, he respected him, he offered, circumambulated him, he bowed his head and offered his obeisances. But it was done with full sincerity. So after fully satisfying him in this way, Amsuman brought back the horse meant for sacrifice. And with this horse, Maharaj Sagara performed the remaining ritualistic ceremonies. After delivering charge of his kingdom to Amsuman, and thus being freed from all material anxiety and bondage, Saga Maharaj, following the means instructed by Orva Muni, achieved the supreme destination. Anuttama Gatim. Lebhe Gatim Anuttamam. Achieve the supreme destination. It means transcendental destination. Yes, any questions or comments? Anyway, I don't know it. That's one to ask Bhaktivedanta Purna Maharaj. That sounds like it's emanated from his lotus mouth. Did it? I've also heard, that reminded me of another one that I never heard any Shastic reference for, that a Brahmin gets money, whatever money he gets in one day, he spends it by the end of the day. And a Vaishnava spends it first and then gets it after. I never heard any Shastic reference for that one.
That sounds like a promotion for the
Any other questions or comments?
Well, you know,
you're giving a purport to why that makes sense.
Yeah, but
regardless of many options or one option, only Krishna sees things completely. Regardless of whether which of the modes we're in, of material nature we're in, we don't have a full feel for reality. Only Krishna knows reality. And therefore it's also said, this there are references for, that in the absence of an acharya, that if you get six Brahmins together, and they can come to a common opinion, that is to be accepted in Kali Yuga.
What is that?
It's on my hard drive. I have that kind of a memory. It's from Parasara Samhita or something like that. Something like that. Well, that's... But also he was the acharya of the... So everyone listened to him too. But yeah, and also he was a very experienced manager. It wasn't only that he was like empowered. He was an experienced manager too. He knew how to deal with the material world and the material energy. So there's always that interesting where there's a junction between the spiritual energy and the material energy. It's quite inconceivable. You're thinking of your recent past, huh? Trying to figure out what just happened the last week. Still trying to find the Shastic reference to prove they're wrong. No.
Trying to illuminate you.
Be sincere, know what Krishna wants, and somehow this way or this way, this way. One of Prabhupada's expertises was that he got everyone able to give the directions, and got people to be able to follow him. They had so much respect and trust in him. Because how much can one man do by himself? So therefore, cooperation is... Abhay, did you want to make a comment or a question? That was in this canto, by the way. I think it was earlier in this canto. But we're going so fast. Yes, so where is it? What should we do and what should we... Where should we depend on Krishna to do it? Well, yeah, that's always a tricky question, but the basic idea is we have to know what our service is and what our duty is, and we should do that to the best of our ability, and we should depend on Krishna for the results. And then if something wonderful happens, we shouldn't think that I've done it. We should think Krishna has done it. It's his mercy. And if something terrible happens, then we can think I've done it. We can think. If we tried sincerely, but the essence of it is to first know what your duty is, to know what your service is. Because we're accepting that we're servants of Krishna. So the first question we should ask is, what is my service? And automatically we see what's our business and what's not our business. And then we stop trying to solve the world's problems. We just be servants and do what with our service, do our duty. And immediately half our anxiety will just disappear. And it should be clear what our service is. Because as soon as you know what your service is, to Krishna is, you'll immediately know what it isn't also. So it's better to make it clear. Does that answer you? And then depend on Krishna for the results. As long as it's generally one of service and upward. As long as it's the general direction it's taking you is upward. And I mean, you can choose which one you want to do too, you know, at this stage in your Krishna consciousness. So it also helps is to have someone that you can say a spiritual authority or what I call an absolute reference point. So you say, I'd like to do this to sanction it for us, so to speak. It's difficult without that, because one can remain quite on the mental platform. Should I be doing this? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing that or this or this? So it's helpful if one has that an absolute reference point, someone that we trust in such a way that we'll actually accept what they say is correct or incorrect, as correct, and referring to what we're doing is incorrect or correct. Follow what I mean? So without that, if we don't have that, and you can't artificially have it if you don't have it, then what you do is use your intelligence as best as you can and sincerely pray to Krishna that if I'm not acting in such a way, if you want me to do something else, please just let me know. I'll shift. I'm not attached to doing this. I'm attached to pleasing you. And please adjust me if required. Because otherwise you can just go through, you know, you can go 20 years thinking, should I be doing this? And you're doing it for 20 years already. Should I be doing this? Should I be doing something else? And then all you're doing is just the wheels are spinning. And then you're not able to make your offer. You put yourself into your offering because you don't know if you should be doing it or not. So if you decide this is what I'm going to do, unless Krishna tells me to do something else, Krishna indicates to me I should do something else, then do it fully. And don't be mental. Another simple way is that, you know, you stay at the manor, for example. So you just speak to the devotees, you know, the people who are in the managerial strand. And they say, this is what I like to do. Okay? Is that all right?
And so, grappling with this conundrum in these verses, prayers of Anshuman, the first he says, they cannot see you even while seeing, because like my uncles, they saw you, but they didn't see you, because they're ignorant. And only those who are pure from the three modes, like four kumars, they can see you. And how can I see you? I am so covered with ignorance, I definitely can't see you.
But at least he wasn't covered with pride. So that's a first step. So he had some humility. And also, in fact, he had knowledge. Because look what he began saying. And as soon as he saw Kapila Muni, he offered obeisances, respected him. So the others were proud. Specifically mentioned that, of their prowess. He was humble.
How did he know this?
Huh?
How did he know?
Why did he suffer from the same pride?
He was born of a different mother, different sanskars. Look who his father was. His father was a Jati Smara. He was a complete transcendentalist. Let me just see. He recognized him as the Super Soul, the Supreme Lord. But there's obviously some transference of mercy to him. Yeah. What do you mean by direct devotional service?
Like seeing, hearing.
The hearing, chanting, etc.
Yes.
Yeah. Navanga Bhakti.
Yeah. And trying to appreciate these.
But what's the essence of the other part?
Purification.
Yeah, what's the essence of purification? What does it mean to become purified? Yes, that's all it means. If you give up pride, you've given up everything, because then you won't be attached to anything, because you realize that you're completely insignificant. So purification means to feel yourself trinadapisini trinaturodapisisna amanina manadena kirtana then kirtaniya sadhari. It means to be humble. That's basically it. I mean, absence of false ego. A false sense of one's greatness. It's false. And a true sense of one's insignificance.
It means
then it was effective.
Almost funny. Only when he says, I cannot see you, then he actually sees. Is it so?
That's
I mean, from verse to verse, you can't say that. But yeah, only when we give up our ability, our trust in our own abilities, and take shelter of Krishna's kindness, can we see. Yes. There has to be a surrender. It has to be a holding, a dependence on His mercy at the same time as feeling oneself humble. If we just feel ourselves lowly and meek without depending on Krishna, then we'll just be crazy. We'll just be another neurotic person in this world. Self-indulgently thinking about oneself and how bad one is continuously. So when that's coupled with a holding on to Krishna, it's wonderful. And how to hold on to Krishna? Sravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smaranam, padasevanam, archanam, bandhanam, dasyam, sakyam, arnanam, vedanam.
There is no two parts, it's all one.
It's the soul becoming more like a soul. That's the one part. That means removing what's false and holding on to what's real. You could do it in two parts, but it's really, it seems to be one part, one process. Because you can't really hold on to Krishna unless you're free from false ego and humble. Prideless.
Yeah, so it seems like a vicious circle. You can't hold on to Krishna unless you are purified. You can't be purified unless you hold on to Krishna.
Well, it's a circle. So it's a, you could say it's a merciful spiral instead of a vicious circle. From the spiral. In other words, when you're looking at it from the top, it looks like you're not getting anywhere. You're just going around in circles, or looking at it from underneath.
All right.
But actually, you're moving towards Krishna.
That's what I meant. It's like 2 feet. First, left foot forward,
then
right foot forward, left foot forward, like this.
I mean, but, okay. Or I like the spiral one myself. But only as we get a taste, we can become... Or only as we become more humble when Krishna is attracted to give us mercy. But you know, there's other elements too. You know, there's just sincerely trying to please Krishna. If we sincerely try to please Guru and Krishna, to please Prabhupada, and it's a sincere attempt, and we're hearing and chanting. Just life will teach us. Just life teaches. A devotional life teaches you. And Krishna's hand is in there too. It's like He'll confront you with a problem, take away all alternatives, except the correct alternative, then you move forward and then say, oh, very good. You're advancing, very good. And then you advance a little bit and everyone say, oh, you're so advanced. Oh, yes, I'm so advanced. And then you have to deal with that. And then you have to really be convinced, no, I'm not. I'm just an insignificant soul. And whatever little I have is just by grace. By causeless mercy too. So, because we want to understand it in a mechanical way. So that's why I didn't want to put it, you know, like this, because it's not actually mechanical, because it's springing from Krishna's kindness. So you could say it's like this. The way we used to say it is we take one step to Krishna with our endeavor, and then He takes so many to us. So that's His causeless mercy. Okay.
So this asamandhyasa comes and goes very quickly in this chapter. And he performs some very prepared activities to just breaking his father's attachment, affection, then he just sort of like disappears.
Forever.
What the relevance of that is.
Well, we talked about that yesterday, that type of a thing. We also went through like 6 or 7 generations.
But because you perform those activities, the message...
And how about Mandatta? Mandatta also did something great, and then there was Paranjaya, who fought the demigods. He had 3 names. He rode on Indra. It all comes. They're glorious. They build a kingdom. Champapur. This, that, and they go. So how does that make you feel? Why would the Bhagavatam present it like that? Because we should understand that time is relentless. And you just, it's going to push. We have our time to do what we're going to do, and then we disappear too. And where will we go? This is meant to give us detachment. Watching the passage of all these kings.
But why would Asana and Jasa suddenly revive all those people so the father would actually then start lamenting the loss of his son? If he really wanted to break that affection from him,
And then it came up, his attachment came up.
I thought about because actually he was not a bad person, and it wouldn't be good for the father to keep thinking bad about some great personality.
It's interesting.
To increase his devotion for great personalities.
Maybe, but I said that he was, you know, look what he did, how he dealt with his father, look how Jadbharat dealt with his father. But however they dealt with him, what a great person he dealt with him, and just the way he wanted to deal with them. So we may understand, we may be able to figure it out, you know, 10,000 years later. We may not be able to figure it out. It really doesn't make any difference. They do what they do, these personalities. We saw that with Prabhupada too. You know, some things he did then we couldn't understand, now we still can't understand. Some things he did then we couldn't understand, now we do understand. But whether I understand or I don't understand doesn't mean anything to anyone but me. You know, it's just like a big deal. I understand, I don't understand. No one cares at all. And that's something very hard to deal with when you have a big false ego. You just, you know, no one cares, really. Why do you think this? No one cares. Just sit down. That's life, you know. It's hard to swallow when you have a big false ego. But we're not meant to have a big false ego. Or it doesn't do us any good to have a big false ego. Because even if thousands of people do care, in 10,000 years, no one will care that thousands of people cared. No one will even know. And 10,000 years is like nothing. It's like nothing. So what is important is none of these things. It's if we can advance a little spiritually. That's important. That is eternal. That gain is eternal. Yes.
So he's asking, in reference to the human sacrifices.
Yeah.
What pleasure do the devas get from self sacrifices?
Well, but I've in the, these are stories from the Mahabharata mostly, and there's one that I read that describes how. There was one king had one son, and his one son was screaming. And it put him in so much anxiety because he thought his one son was going to die. So his priest said, So his conclusion was, it's better to have no sons than one son, because you're always in anxiety. Of course, it's somewhat of a different culture. You know, the king, for his own purpose, for the progeny, for the next king, he needed that. So then his priest performed a sacrifice, and his one son was sacrificed in that. But the smoke from his burning body entered the nostrils of his other queens, and they all had children, or something like that. So there are ritualistic, mechanical ways to do different activities. It's not only they're pleased by it. It's just there's mechanical methodologies of they're pleased by when the mechanics are followed, and then say by their benediction they have the power to do these things. So they're pleased that the rules of the Vedic sacrifice, if there's any pleasure, it's that. That's why Krishna is pleased too. That's the empowerment of the Vedas. That Krishna said to do this, and you follow it, and he's pleased because it's his words. So in the same way, the Devas, if in any way that it's not they're separately pleased, but if they are, they're pleased because this is the system, this is the Vedic system. That's would be my answer to that. Vedic system means following the Vedas. And interestingly enough, it took so much of the Brahmin priest piety to do that, he had to go to hell after that, to perform that. So someone is pleased, someone is displeased. It's life. Any other tricky question from Damien? Ambarisha's father.
Huh?
Ambarisha Maharaj's father? Navada.
Yes. Yes. He was left with an inheritance, and then his father sent him to a sacrifice, and then Shiva came. So there in the Shruti Pali it says that whoever remembers this story in the morning and in the evening becomes very learned in the Vedas. So I just wonder how exactly one will become. Is there any other reason except, aside from mystical power of this story, is there any other logical explanation how this story would help one to become?
Well, there was another one like that. That someone we read it yesterday. That someone Narmada brought down to, and they fought the Kandavas and by the blessings of the. And anyone who hears this story will have no fear of snakes anymore.
That's understandable because he helped the snakes. So okay,
you could say it's understandable from that point of view, but if the snakes help him, bless him, how is that going to help you if you hear this story or remember the story? Okay, well, that's what you were asking about. There's the magical part, but how about the mechanical part? You were asking about the mechanical part. A lot of them seem to be just blessings. In other words, you can.
Maybe, I don't know if my reasoning is correct, maybe it's that one will understand that all the sacrifices are meant for the, not for our pleasure. All the rewards that the priest had gathered actually belong to Shiva. So maybe that's the part that makes one truly understand the Vedic verses and Vedic hymns.
But what was the exact one? So,
because Shiva came and claimed all the wealth. And Bhagavad actually admitted, yes, it's actually yours.
Yes.
So maybe that's the part that makes one truly understand the Vedic verses.
You mean the conclusion of the Vedas?
But notice it was Vishnu, wasn't Vishnu, it was Shiva. Yes. Well, then you have to add another step in to it, and after all, Shiva is just empowered, good avatar. No, unless the acharyas comment on these things, I really don't have much. I guess in that culture, so many more things were understood than we understand, too. Did you have a question? And he had been tricked. But he went anyway. That's also interesting. Yes?
I don't know that part. I mean, there is one verse 10 in that story.
Which story is this?
That one of Lord Shiva.
What chapter are we...
Chapter 4.
Yes.
In verse 10, it says, Lord Shiva says, whatever your father has said is the truth. And you also are speaking the same truth. Therefore, I, who knows the Vedic mantras, shall explain transcendental knowledge to you. So anyone who hears the story will get that same knowledge that Lord Shiva has explained. Lord Shiva says, I am the knower of the Vedas, I am the knower of the Vedic mantras. So then the benediction is there. It's related to that, the benediction.
That the knowledge that Lord Shiva gave him.
Yeah, because here Lord Shiva specifically says that he presents himself as me who knows the Vedic mantra.
Okay, where were you reading from exactly, please?
It's verse 10 in chapter
4.
And then he says, I shall explain transcendental knowledge to you. It means that Shiva actually gave transcendental knowledge to Nabhaga. So anyone who hears this story, the benediction is you will get understanding of the Vedic hymns. That's directly related?
It's definitely directly related, but it doesn't explain the mechanics of it, which is what you were more asking. Or no, you were asking about the relationship.
Yeah,
so that answers it.
Also, like, when Lord Shiva's blessing, you get a special blessing from Lord Shiva.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nice that katha came up. Yeah, and then, but we should end then.
I don't know if you'll answer it now, or you'll answer it some other time, but it's a question. This story in Canto 9 speaks about Vaishnava, about Ambarish and Durvasa. And we had a similar story in Canto 4 with Daksha and Shiva. And in both cases, you can see the grievous, unfortunate outcome for the perpetrator of the offense. But still, five cantos later, is there any difference to this story? What makes this story different from the previous story of Vaishnava Parak? Because we assume that the philosophy progresses as we go through the cantos. Canto 4 taught us don't come in Vaishnava Prabhu. Canto 9 also uses don't come in Vaishnava Prabhu in this story. But is there some added twist to it or some added...
I'd have to think. Well, there's certainly more about the methodology of removing the Vaishnava apparat. That neither Brahma nor Lord Shiva could do it, nor even Lord Vishnu could do it. And also those wonderful verses where Lord Vishnu himself explains that his relationship with his devotees. So it's much more intimate, explaining how extraordinary. This one really seems to, that one is more on against, specifically against Vaishnava Bharat. This one really seems to stress the intimacy of the Lord and his devotees more. That seemed to me quite clear, that point. And then you ask, why is it that the Lord is, it's obvious that the, like even Shiva was meditating upon the Lord in his heart, as the Paramatma in his heart, but we didn't see the Lord meditating on Lord Shiva. So this the reciprocation, the nearness and dearness of the, it's not only that the devotees are thinking about Krishna, that whole other side, which is really important to understand Canto 10, how Krishna is fully captivated and controlled. He said, "Aswatantra, I've lost my independence due to my devotees." So it seems to be that seems to. I always assume that the part of Vaishnava Bharat, avoid Vaishnava, really isn't the message of that, but rather it's you naturally assume not to do that when you see the nearness, the intimacy. That's what seems to be stressed in Ambarish, the intimacy of the Lord and his devotees. Yes?
I was thinking also it could establish the fact further that the topics on Bhagavatam are scattered throughout the whole Bhagavatam, because we're talking about Purushanam. So Jiva Goswami explained that the 10 topics are scattered anyway, amongst all the cantos. So Purushanam appears twice, but as you said, it's more intimate, this type of Purushanam is more intimate with Ambarish. So it corroborates the point of Jiva Goswami that all the topics are scattered.
See, if you use the example of a spiral, say, so it's like this, and if you look at it from the top view of the spiral, you could see it all looks like there's some here and here and here and here, some of the different topics of the Bhagavatam, but you look at the side view and you see that one is actually, indeed, it's closer to the 10th canto, so that, and it will also be so interesting. Certain things that are very important will naturally be stressed more than once, especially when you go into the most intimate parts. And interestingly enough, you know, later on in this canto, still later, one of the last pastimes that's even talked about is there's Purarava and Urvasi, and there's Yayati talking that sex life can never satisfy you. And then, so that's been mentioned before. But, and then even Parsaram. How wonderful. When he kills, it's the most glorious thing, because whatever the Lord does is glorious. Sex life is the worst thing. It has to be given up. Closing on Canto 10.
Similar blessing is for reading Srimad Bhagavad-gita, some particular chapter you get this. My understanding is that the blessing is like you get chance to, like Vedic knowledge means you get chance to learn Vedic knowledge. Like similarly, you going back to home means you get that opportunity to go back.
It's not magical, automatic, except on that level. But also so many unwanted benedictions are given too. I guess we'll see if they're unwanted. You want to go to heaven? Okay, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.